Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Coming up on today's program, Dayton Youth Radio, also County Lines with producer Renee Wild. And we've got news from the Ohio State House News Bureau. Up first, around 5 years ago, a grassroots support group started in Dayton to help people struggling with a loved one's addiction. It's called FOA. For families of addicts. And central to the group's mission is an effort to break down the stigma that often surrounds the opioid epidemic. For WISO News, Community Voices producer Jason Reynolds attended an FOA meeting and has this story.
All right, you guys, so we're going to go ahead and start.
It's 7:30 on a Wednesday evening, and Lori Irian is hosting a meeting of the Dayton support group called Families of Addicts, or FOA. We're in a big room. Dozens of people are sitting at folding tables. Most have come to find help for themselves or to figure out how to help a loved one struggling with addiction. The rest are addicts in recovery. Arian opens the meeting with a story about why she founded FOA.
I started FOA as a result of having my own recovery experience and then finding out that my daughter was using heroin.
During the meeting, people stand up to share their own stories or to offer their services. There are addiction counselors from various rehab centers and programs. Some of them are professionals, some are volunteers who are in recovery themselves. There are service providers that can help people fill out insurance paperwork or access Narcan, a drug used to reverse an overdose. At tonight's meeting, there's a public health van out front offering HIV testing, and inside, there's a table where people can get fentanyl test strips, which help prevent accidental overdoses. A lot of people at the meeting identify themselves as grandparents who are raising grandchildren because of addiction. One of them is Paul Bertke, who goes by the nickname Buck. He says his stepdaughter has been using drugs since she was a teenager. She's 30 now and just completed detox, again. Buck and his wife are raising three of his stepdaughter's children. He says the oldest of the children, who is still in grade school, has seen a lot.
My granddaughter, her dad, he overdosed, so he died. So they don't have a dad anymore. She's only 10 years old. You know, we have put her through counseling and so forth, but... that's always there.
Buck says it's hard to speak with young children about addiction, but they usually know more than adults think they do, especially when they've seen adults overdose and be arrested. And he tells me that helping relatives with addiction issues is tough because it's often trial and error. Most attendees agree. They say there's no one-size-fits-all approach to helping a loved one, and it's hard to find a balance between helping and enabling. But they also agree that there are a lot of resources out there. The real trick, they say, is matching a person in recovery to the right resource, the one that will help that person stay sober. That's what appears to be happening with one brother and sister at this meeting.
My name's Tiffany. I've been in recovery now. My clean date is 6 months and 14 days.
Tiffany shares some difficult stories. She says she's overdosed multiple times, had friends die, and did 2 stints in prison. But she finally sought help for her addiction. Then she started documenting her recovery on social media, which inspired her little brother.
He kept on telling me on Facebook, I'm so proud of you, I want what you have, you know, I look up to you, and he's never looked up to me. We've always struggled in our addictions, and we always got high together, but we never got sober together.
Tiffany spoke to the woman who runs the sober living house where she's been staying, and they were able to arrange a room for her brother, Jeremy. Then they drove over 2 hours to pick him up and bring him back. Jeremy says he's happy to be under the same roof as his sister again, and to be sober.
I thank God every day when I wake up. Because I look at her like she saved my life, for real. She really did. Like, I came up here weighing like 115. I'm weighing 154 now. You know, in 31 days, I gained that much more weight.
Like Tiffany and Jeremy, most people at FOA are open and vocal about their struggles. FOA is not an anonymous group, and that was by design. FOA founder Lori Arian says she had an epiphany after watching a documentary about addiction and recovery.
In that movie, it talked about the 23 million people in long-term recovery that aren't saying anything. And I thought, well, I'm one of those people. That is that aha moment I had when I was like, yeah, we need to be talking about this.
While the rate of overdose death in Dayton recently declined, the opioid epidemic shows no signs of letting up. Across the country, more than 70,000 people died of an overdose last year. That's an unprecedented number. FOA has a big goal for 2019. They plan to start a phone hotline that will link people touched by addiction to the services they need. And they're hoping that hotline will save lives. For WISO News, I'm Community Voices producer Jason Reynolds.
For more about FOA, Families of Addicts, and to see photos from this meeting, visit our website at WISO.org. And this week on Dayton Youth Radio, we have a story from a teenager that realized parents can be both positive and negative role models, all the while loving them. Here's project coordinator Basim Blunt.
What happens when parents allow their children to see their flaws, frailties, and mistakes?
I'm Gwen Mayo. I'm a 17-year-old senior at Centerville High School, and I'm a certified buzzkill. I'm that person that's always worrying about figuring out the plan, being responsible, and keeping everyone around me out of trouble. My friends call me the mom of the group. I had to grow up really fast due to situations I've dealt with at home. My dad has always been a kid at heart and known to do wild things or act unreasonably, usually without really thinking it through. I recall a cold day in February when my dad had me film him as he ran through the powdered snow, climbed up a tree wearing nothing but a Greek toga, angel wings, and holding an oversized bow and arrow he decorated to look like Cupid's bow, all for just a video to post on Snapchat.
I will never change. I'm not gonna be a prude who just stays in the house and watches Nightline every night and goes to bed at 9 o'clock and then in 10 years starts to go to MCL cafeteria for dinner.
My dad has been drinking since I was little, but I didn't recognize it as a problem until after my parents' divorce.
Like, I didn't want a divorce, and how could I go from seeing my kids all the time to only seeing them half time? I didn't even get to see them half time. That it's Wednesdays and every other weekends, and then even that wasn't stuck to.
Whenever he's out late with friends at bars or a house, I spend my night worrying that something might happen to him. On a chilly day last winter, on his way home, he had fallen asleep and driven into someone's yard. He received a DUI and his license was suspended for 9 months.
I regret some of those things, and I'm sorry for them, and I don't want to have that be the norm going forward.
I worry about everyone, but specifically you. I worry about you. I worry about drinking, driving, not really thinking through the stuff that you're doing or your destructive behaviors and how it affects you and how that, like, in turn affects me. But I do believe that you are making steps to try and get better. Like, you're seeing your therapist very frequently and you're, like, actively doing stuff to be better, which makes me less worried, but it's still, like, it's hard, right?
It's hard. Honestly, my biggest fear in life is that you'll be so disappointed that you'll disown me. That's the last thing I want.
I did this story because I was very, very mad at my dad. I think that other people can relate to it maybe if they have a parent who deals with alcoholism like my dad does. I don't know. So yeah, I was very angry. But now, like, I realize there's a lot of stuff that I need to talk to my dad about, but most importantly, we need change. And I think that this is a perfect opportunity for that.
I do care. I care how I see myself. And so I'm trying to fix things in me that are broken or hurt or that cause self-destructive behavior or patterns.
You are always going to be my dad. Even if you make a lot of mistakes, you're always going to be my dad. And I'm always still going to love you. And I don't ever want to not at least try to have you around. So thank you for doing this interview. Is there anything else you want to add?
I love you.
I love you too.
For Dayton Youth Radio at Centerville High School, this is Gwen Mayo.
I was walking through icy streams that took my breath away. Moving slowly through.
That was Father Daughter Dance, written and produced by Gwen Mayo, a senior at Centerville High School. Special thanks to Sean Mayo, Gwen's dad, and Trisha Raybach, her teacher. For Dayton Youth Radio, this is Basim Blunt.
Support for Dayton Youth Radio comes from the Virginia W. Kettering Foundation and the Ohio Arts Council. Find more stories on our website at wyso.org. I'm Jerry Kenny. This is Why So Weekend. Thanks again for joining us. Here in Southwest Ohio, it's not hard to find small county towns that were thriving 50 years ago but are now struggling to survive. They're all subject to similar economic forces, but each one has its own story. In Greene County, the village of Jamestown has about 2,000 people today, slightly more than 50 years ago. But what Jamestown has lost is its vital downtown. Renee Wild has this story for County Lines.
In the 1900s, Jamestown, Ohio was described as one of the most wide awake, enterprising, and prosperous towns in Greene County. Now, the Victorian-era storefronts lining the downtown street are mostly vacant.
My name is Ted Sessler, lifelong resident of Jamestown, the town barber. And what I don't hear in here, I hear out there.
Ted's barbershop sits in the center of the village by the town's only stoplight. He describes what it was like in the 50s.
We had a lot of businesses here. We had everything we needed. We wouldn't even have to go to Xenia for anything. Okay, we had a movie theater, two meat markets, five barbershops, two restaurants, one bank, dry cleaning, shoe store, two car dealerships. We had everything we needed. And we were all farmers. So they all came to town on Saturday night, and you couldn't even walk down the street. 5,000 people be in town on Saturday night.
This was also the time when a former farm out on the western edge of the village was developed into a man-made lake ringed by houses. The Shawnee Lake subdivision doubled the population of Jamestown in just one decade as people from Dayton and Xenia relocated to the area.
It brought a lot of people from the city into this local community, which forced us to build schools and update a lot of our fire department and police department. So we have progressed in that area, but the downtown section needs a lot of revamping.
When I ask if there was a turning point for the downtown, Ted is quick to respond.
Well, we had several fires in town, and the fires never across the street there, for example, was four buildings, and it all burnt down.
Across the street, Something New Florist has a going out of business sign in the window.
I'm ready to retire. Well, I've been here for 43 years. I'm getting worn out.
Joanne Snell's business was one of those impacted by the series of fires downtown in the 1990s.
It destroyed part of my building, the two buildings adjacent to me. Then it progressively got worse.
Just as the town was recovering from the fires, it was dealt another blow. In 2001, Interstate 35 was finished. The traffic from the old highway that went through the center of downtown was now bypassing Jamestown.
The local traffic is still here in town. But as far as people passing through, that doesn't happen anymore.
It hurt my business because people would come up to the traffic light, look over at me, and I was standing on a corner or down, sitting down on a bench out there, and they said, "Can I get a haircut?" And I said, "Yeah, come on." So I don't have that no more because they go around the bypass now.
The death blow for Jamestown came in 2008. When shipping giant DHL closed in the neighboring town of Wilmington, and 7,000 people lost their jobs.
It really tore us up, yes. That was a major loss. Yeah, yeah. Almost happened overnight.
Unemployment in Jamestown went from 5% to 10% in 1 year. In 2010, the village received almost $2 million in federal money as part of the Neighborhood Stabilization Program, which was created to help restore neighborhoods hit by the county's foreclosure crisis. It was used to demolish three vacant homes and rebuild new houses on the lots, which the town then sold in a sealed bidding process. Two of those houses were located on a side street within the village, and one was at Shawnee Lake. None of that money went to the blighted downtown area.
Well, it could have been a real dent in this place, yeah. Oh, yes. And you got to have people with a vision that want to do that. Until you get those people, it just keeps going down, down, and down.
Two doors down from Ted's barbershop, Sherry Marsden and her husband hoped to be part of that vision. They bought the vacant three-story former Harley-Davidson building, and Sherry's mother moved her hair salon from Xenia into the newly renovated storefront.
It was a good opportunity, and my husband decided to go for it. So I would love to see somebody else open something. I mean, there's so many beautiful buildings. I'd love to see life brought back to the old buildings. I would love a coffee shop.
When the florist shop closes down, Sherry and Ted Marsden will be two of the last three businesses left in the downtown strip. For County Lines on WYSO, Renee Wild, Jamestown, Ohio.
Find more stories from producer Renee Wild and the County Lines series on our website at WYSO.org. In his campaign for governor last year, Republican Mike DeWine accused his Democratic opponent, Richard Cordray, of planning to raise taxes. And now, within weeks of taking office, Governor DeWine is proposing an 18-cent tax hike in Ohio's gas tax to pay for road maintenance and construction. The urgency of the transportation funding was not an issue during the campaign, but has been a slow crescendo in recent weeks. State House correspondent Joe Ingles files this report.
Last fall, the DeWine campaign aired this ad.
The last thing we need are higher taxes.
But that's exactly what Richard Cordray would do.
It's a charge DeWine repeatedly made in ads and in debates, saying Cordray would need to raise taxes to pay for all he wanted to do. And it's one Cordray denied over and over again.
We do not need to raise taxes in Ohio. What I will do is raise paychecks.
Infrastructure wasn't a marquee issue in the campaign, but it did come up. And as it turns out, DeWine did as he said he would in July when he said he would appoint a committee to look into ways to pay for infrastructure repair and maintenance. He also never totally ruled out a gas tax increase, but Cordray never suggested a gas tax increase at all. Instead, he said he'd put a $1.8 billion bond issue before voters that would provide money to fix and maintain Ohio's roads and bridges, as well as expand broadband and build new infrastructure projects, all of which he said would create jobs. Essentially, it would allow the state to go into debt, something previous governors have done. Most recently, Republican former Governor John Kasich leased the Ohio Turnpike in a bond package in 2012. While it was praised at the time, it created the problem that Ohio Department of Transportation Director Jack Marchbanks says the state is now dealing with in the form of $394 million in debt service payments each year. Marchbanks says the proposed 18-cent a gallon increase in the gas tax, or user fee as he and DeWine call it, is needed, but stops short of criticizing Kasich and his predecessors for taking on the debt.
I was not on watch when those decisions were made. I will not comment on whether or not it was a failure of leadership.
DeWine says he didn't know the extent of the debt problem at ODOT when running for office, but has more facts now.
It is not the prudent thing to do to borrow more money so that we can postpone the day of reckoning a year or 2 years or 3 years. I just don't think that's responsible.
Marchbanks says someone who drives 13,000 miles a year would pay $2.65 more for gas per week for a 2015 Ford F-150 pickup, $1.91 more if they had a 2015 Jeep Cherokee, or $1.61 more per week if they have a 2015 Honda Accord. Democratic State Representative Bridget Kelly questions whether that type of tax is fair for everyone, especially minimum wage earners who get $8.65 an hour.
You know, we talk about $1.61 or $2.65, and so for people in this room, it might not seem like that much, but for people that are trying to make ends meet and can't, that can be prohibitive. Yes. And it can be prohibitive from helping them to get to work, to get to school, and to help themselves and their families to have a better life.
Marchbanks says he thinks ultimately this tax will end up helping the working poor by improving the overall economy. And that, he says, can mean those people are able to move out of minimum or low-wage jobs. But advocates for public transit say that cannot happen without the state somehow making a significant investment in public transportation. Stu Nicholson with Move Ohio says there are already companies looking to hire, but can't because workers can't get to them.
If they can't bring in the workers to improve their business, then you're getting hurt at both ends.
Public transit advocates say they want lawmakers to commit a significant investment right now while the gas tax is being considered. Gas tax revenues can only go to roads and bridges, but Marchbanks has said some federal transportation funds could be moved to public transit if more state revenue is available. Joel Engels at the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau.
I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. In southwest Ohio, you've heard the name Huffman. There's Huffman Historic District, Huffman Metro Park, Huffman Dam, the Huffman Building, Huffy Bikes. And so WYSO listener Joanne Howard wanted to know, who is Huffman? Sheila Raghavandran has this story for WYSO Curious.
The answer to Joanne's question takes us back to 1812, when William Huffman, the first in this Huffman legacy, moved to Dayton, which was a not-so-glamorous place at the time. There wasn't much development or transportation.
Back in the middle 1800s, your ability to be able to get around was limited to your legs or a horse, or a horse-drawn vehicle.
That's Tom Morrow from the Dayton Railway Historical Society. William Huffman's son, William P. Huffman, knew Dayton residents needed a way to get around. He owned land on the outskirts of town and wanted people to build homes there. So he and his business partner created the Third Street Railway, which
was more or less a mechanism to be able to convince people to build a home in those outlying regions.
Dayton grew around the Third Street Railway, and William P. Huffman had made a name for himself. There were more Huffmans to come. According to Ryan Qualls, who works at the National Park Service, William P. had 10 children.
William, Martha, Lydia, Charles.
And Elizabeth, many of them were notable, Lawrence, like a son who helped develop sewers and a daughter who married into the family that built the Dayton Arcade. Then there was Torrence Huffman, who lent land to a couple of guys named Wilbur and Orville. You might know them as the Wright brothers. That land, east of Dayton, was where they developed the first practical airplane. Today, it's known as Huffman Prairie. But back then, it wasn't known for planes. It was known for cows.
The Wrights were able to make use of the cow pasture for several years during the early experiments and then with their flight school and as a test field for their company. This area, I believe, helped to further on their idea that they were working with a mindset of just limitless possibility.
Limitless possibility is a good way to describe the Huffman family, too. Torrence's brother George led the Davis Sewing Machine Company in the late 1800s. They also tried making bikes, but Qualls said they had difficulty competing with early cars and motorcycles.
And that affected that overall business. They ended up liquidating the assets from the company and reformed it as the Huffman Manufacturing Company. They made equipment for early automobiles, service stations, and bicycle wheels, and then they began producing bicycles again.
Those bicycles were called Huffy Bikes, a name that's now known around the world. Horace Huffman's son, also named Horace, joined the company and became a champion for some of the bike trails that are still around today. The Huffmans probably would not have expected their name to be on so many landmarks in Dayton, but to Qualls, it's no surprise.
That Huffman name has really survived because of the lasting effort they made. The Huffmans were really interested in kind of promoting Dayton and seeing Dayton last forever.
Thanks to Joanne Howard for her question. For Why So Curious, I'm Sheila Raghavandran.
Why So Curious is our series where you ask the questions and Why So producers answer them on the air. Tell us what you're curious about by visiting our website, wyso.org. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Ohio's top elections official says giving workers a day off for Election Day is an interesting idea, but he's not convinced it's the one and only solution. State House correspondent Andy Chow asked all of the statewide office holders about the idea to grow voter participation.
The city of Sandusky moved its paid city holiday from Columbus Day in October to Election Day. Local leaders said they wanted to prioritize that time as a holiday to give workers the chance to vote. A similar move has been proposed by members of the Cincinnati City Council. Secretary of State Frank LaRose says it's an interesting idea, and he encourages more cities to have this debate.
Anything that we can do to increase voter participation, to encourage more people to get involved, we should be doing it. And that means trying things like this is worth doing.
LaRose says making Election Day a holiday was a subject of conversation at the National Secretaries of State Conference recently. He says he heard concerns as well, even among voter advocates, that this could have an unintentional adverse effect.
If you have a Tuesday off, that makes you want to take a Monday off. And turn that into a four-day weekend and take the kids and go away for a few days, that causes the actual sort of inverse of what we're looking to have, and that's participation.
LaRose was asked about the idea of making Election Day a holiday at the Ohio AP's Legislative Preview Conference during a forum with the four statewide executive office holders, all of whom happen to be Republican. Attorney General Dave Yost says he's not taking a stance one way or another on the idea, but he does have concerns when it comes to fairness.
If we're going to have a national holiday, it needs to have an even application, meaning everything needs to close down and we need to have it equally accessible to everybody.
Auditor Keith Faber echoes Yost's concerns and says another route is encouraging leaders in the private sector to allow their employees more flexibility during the election season.
So that people can, you know, take a little longer lunch to go vote or vote earlier.
As Faber noted, Ohioans have the opportunity to vote at their local boards of elections up to 4 weeks before Election Day. LaRose says the state gives ample opportunity to vote, not only in person, but by mail.
So again, whether it's a holiday or not, there's no excuse for people skipping the opportunity to vote.
Catherine Terser with Common Cause Ohio, a voter rights advocacy group, says it's important for federal, state, and local officials to all be thinking about ways to increase voter turnout and election accessibility.
It's an experiment, but it is definitely an experiment that's worth doing because voting is so important.
LaRose says he's glad Sandusky, which is located in Erie County, is trying this idea.
The upside is that my hope would be now that the Erie County Board of Elections has an easier time recruiting poll workers because you've got hundreds of city employees that are not going to be on duty that day. And all the boards of elections all around the state are always looking for poll workers. And so now with all those folks having a day off, it should encourage that.
So far, 13 states have made Election Day a paid holiday for state employees. That includes Michigan, Kentucky, and Indiana. Andy Chow, at the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. For the first week of early spring, the third week of the skunk-courting moon, and the first week of the sun in Pisces, the week of cross-quarter day, the halfway point, the spring equinox. The shift of weather that multiplies the signs of spring takes place within a week of cross-quarter day, the day on which the sun reaches halfway to spring equinox, February 18th. Three or four good thaws, sometimes lasting a week apiece, have already come up from the south before then. Bulbs made progress during each of them, foliage rising ever so slowly through the soft ground. Cardinals not only sing before dawn now, but deep into the afternoon. Peonies sometimes come up through the mulch, their bright tips emerging at the arrival of red-winged blackbirds, robins, bluebirds. When blue jays start calling and when sparrows and starlings are loud and reckless in the middle of mating. On the other side of cross-quarter day, pussy willows open up all the way. Along with the earliest snowdrops and aconites, the signs accelerate, accumulate, and become the new season itself, turning into what they represent by force of numbers. And then what looks the same as any winter day is really a day in early spring. The wind may still be raw and the grass and the trees are brown, but the balance has tipped anyway. The thaws are preserved, their effects impervious to the steady progression of cold fronts, and winter is decaying headlong, collapsing into rebirth. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again with notes for the second week of early spring and the final week of the skunk-courting moon. In the meantime, look for all the signs even in the cold. When you have enough signs, then you have spring.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958, thanks to generous listeners like you. I'm Jerry Kenny. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. Coming up next on WYSO, it's Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.